My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you like it when you lived here?
I did, and I so didn't expect to. I mean, I went from Berkeley with this huge Berkeley chip on my shoulder. I hate LA. I hate LA people. And I loved it almost instantly. It's a very easy place to live.
I know. I don't know if it was Jimmy Stewart. There was some great movie star who was like, the thing about LA is that you go out and you go for a swim when you're 25 and you lay down on the sun lounger. And when you go back in the house, you're 84.
It's so true.
It's so true. It's like, oh, no time's passed at all. It's like, no, you're 100. No, I'm not. You really are.
Hello, I'm Minnie Driver. Welcome to Mini Questions Season 2. I've always loved Proust's questionnaire. It was originally a 19th century parlor game where players would ask each other 35 questions aimed at revealing the other player's true nature. It's just the scientific method, really. In asking different people the same set of questions, you can make observations about which truths appear to be universal. I love this discipline. And it made me wonder, what if these questions were just the jumping-off point? What greater depths would be revealed if I asked these questions as conversation starters with thought leaders and trailblazers across all these different disciplines? So I adapted Proust's questionnaire, and I wrote my own 7 questions that I personally think are pertinent to a person's story. They are, when and where were you happiest? What is the quality you like least about yourself? What relationship, real or fictionalized, defines love for you? What question would you most like answered? What person, place, or experience has shaped you the most? What would be your last meal? And can you tell me something in your life that's grown out of a personal disaster? And I've gathered a group of really remarkable people, ones that I am honored and humbled to have had the chance to engage with. You may not hear their answers to all 7 of these questions. We've whittled it down to which questions felt closest to their experience or the most surprising or created the most fertile ground to connect.
My guest today on Mini Questions is food writer and revolutionary Ruth Reichel. There are very few people who can articulate their passion and point of view with as much clarity and humor. In 2015, she wrote a cookbook called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And the insights she shared about life and its attending pain, along with the recipes, were a constant companion to me in my kitchen and to millions of others. She was editor of the famed Gourmet magazine in its heyday until its very end. Just do yourself a favor and Google David Foster Wallace's piece for that magazine entitled Consider the Lobster. She has repeatedly asked us to look at food differently, to consider how food is made and the provenance of our ingredients. She began doing this at a time when ease and plasticity had become cornerstones of home cooking. My other favourite thing about Ruth are the many characters and disguises she employed to avoid detection while working as a restaurant critic for the New York Times and for the LA Times. I smell a TV show, and I'm off to option this idea as soon as I have finished this.
Where and when were you happiest?
I am one of those people who, once I got past my childhood, have been pretty happy. I mean, I think it's one of my great gifts in life is that I am a generally happy person. I mean, I usually like where I am and who I'm with. And I'm one of those people who never wants to leave a party or, you know, wherever I am. It's a great gift to have that. But probably I loved being at Gourmet. I loved my staff. I loved the people I worked with. I loved the feeling that we were doing something consequential, that we were making a difference. And it was also, you know, my son was 10 then. My husband had a job he really liked. We had money for the first time in our lives. I mean, we weren't worried about, you know, can we pay the rent? And I was just happy in that job. And I learned, I mean, I'd never really been a manager before. And I learned that there's something wonderful about having the ability to pull a staff together and to figure out what made other people happy and how to do that. So, you know, when I look back at my life, it was a great 10 years.
God, it's such a funny thing, isn't it? Like when you find yourself doing something you love and then you also find that you're good at something else you didn't know before, that something's revealed, like in that happiness, another attribute is revealed. But I always think there's like when something's going well in life, like everything's wonderful with my son and everything's great with my partner, I'm like, God damn it, something's going to fuck up on the work front because my three-legged stool is just never going to be balanced. And those moments where it is, where everything just seems to kind of level out, they are pockets of such wonder.
They are. And the other thing about that moment in life was I was doing something that I really didn't know how to do. And I think that is what sort of keeps you alive and young. I mean, that sort of learning process. And that was wonderful too. I mean, there I was in a completely new world for me and sort of navigating my way through it.
Was that being an editor? Was that the part that you didn't know how to do?
Well, I didn't know anything really about how to run a magazine, how to be an editor, how to be a boss. I mean, all of that. I mean, I've been a writer alone pretty much all my life. I'd never been in charge of anything. And, you know, the magazine world, and, you know, I mean, as a newspaper person, you know, newspaper person, people are kind of like grubby. It's a grubby world. And suddenly I'm in this world of glamour. Everything about that job was completely new for me.
Was Gourmet Condé Nast?
Yes.
I think that was what was brilliant about that publishing house as well, was they would sort of ID perfectly unlikely people with the continuance of that brand. Like that, I think, was what made them so brilliant, was that they would go, no, Ruth Reichel should be editing Gourmet, but she's never done it before. Doesn't matter. She'll figure it out.
And I kept saying, you know, you're crazy. You don't want me for this. I don't know how to do it. And Cy Newhouse just kept saying, I want you to do this. And I know you can do it. And the thing about Cy, and the thing that is truly gone forever, is I think he was the last publisher who truly thought that if you give the public something of value, they will pay for it.
Mm.
He was absolutely not cynical about who the audience was and what you gave them. And he said, you know, what do you think is a great magazine? And I said, it's a publication that doesn't give people what they want. It gives them what they didn't know they want. And he said, yes, you're right about that. And I don't think, I mean, today everybody does these focus groups trying to figure out, you know, how do we give the audience what they want so they will pay for it? And Cy had a bigger vision. I mean, he was a very strange man, but he had a bigger vision of what the media should provide to people.
It's weird because it is a service, but it is a creative service. It's the idea that you should only be led by sort of, I don't think it should be the consumer that curates. Like that's the whole point, is that lots of different things in, I guess, one would hope would be curated and then you get to choose, as opposed to the job being what's trendy or what, like you said, a focus group that on that day of the week, 8 people out of the 10 said this thing. But if you ask them the following week, it might well be different.
And the problem with that is, I mean, one of the reasons I really fear for our democracy is that increasingly we're just hearing what we want to hear. I mean, if you let the audience choose what they want to hear, they don't learn anything. You know, they get no new ideas. And that's where we are now, right? You know, so, you know, the people who don't hear the other side and, you know, the people on the other side only hear what they want to hear. And it's a very scary time, I think.
It's a crazy schism that, again, media is feeding into because they're not even trying to, I think, bridge the differences. It is such a chasm now that they're like, okay, well, we're on this side. We're going to curate for our side and the other side will curate for their side. I feel like that must have happened at some other time in history, and that like everything, it's always some sort of path that wends its way and balances out.
You're very optimistic.
I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't the collateral damage of like lost generations, because I think there probably will be. I mean, it's pretty dark right now, I've got to say, but I don't know. I hope for the sake of my kid that it works out, that the journey continues as opposed to it being this dead end that it feels like right now.
I hope you're right. But I just keep thinking about my father used to talk about his father who read 8 newspapers every day. And he read right across the political spectrum.
I try and do that. And it makes my blood boil and makes me feel sick. And that's maybe, you know, where this whole notion of being a bit of a snowflake comes from. I think we have to have a stronger stomach and really start metabolizing what all these different thoughts are about how we should live.
I totally agree with you, but I'm with you. I mean, my husband's very good about it and he reads everything and listens to everything. And then I just go, how can you listen to that?
I know. My boyfriend is the same. He reads all of it. And then that is then synthesized through, you know, the prism of him. But it requires balanced intellectual acuity that I do not have.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
So, golly, it is astonishing the amount of different things that you've done in your life. It really is. Like, I was just looking over your career and it's amazing how many different things you've done. This is off, sort of slightly off topic, but do you find that when you would finish one thing, that even if it was hard, even if there was a fallow period, did you always have a sense that something else would be coming and that you just had to hold your course and just mine whatever this empty moment was and it would lead you into the next thing?
I did. And if it didn't, then I would, you know, go out and actively try and make it happen. But, you know, I feel really fortunate because, you know, having grown up with a really crazy mother, I saw that how my father stayed sane was by always doing work that mattered to him. And so I grew up with this very strong sense of work will save you. And no matter what is going on in your life, if you do work that gives you a sense of purpose, then you'll be okay. So I've always gone to that place. I mean, even at the most despairing moments in my life, it's like, okay, go to work.
And with that for you would be writing. You would just go and just apply the seat of your pants to the chair and just write.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's writing, but sometimes it's just, you know, get a job bussing tables, you know, anything. Just do something. It is the only thing that will bring you back.
So what person, place, or experience most altered your life?
Well, I come back to my mother. I mean, I think, you know, my mother has really been the dominant influence in my life for both good and bad. My mother was bipolar, and she literally never knew who she was going to be when she woke up in the morning. I mean, she went through really wild mood changes, and I literally wake up every morning grateful that I'm not my mother. Grateful for sanity. And I think it's the thing that has been the most defining thing of my life is that relationship with this woman who, you know, made the life of everyone around her really difficult. But in the end, it just made me so grateful to be me. You know, I mean, she was incredibly intelligent. And, you know, I mean, Bertrand Russell asked her to marry him. And
wow.
I have 50 years of letters between my mother and Bertie Russell. And
have you published those?
No. I mean, they're mostly personal, you know, but every once in a while there's something. And she actually took me to meet him when I was 12.
Did you know who he was? I mean, at 12, I can't imagine that.
Oh, you know, I knew who he was because they talked about him all the time. And my father always talked about when Russell was in New York giving a series of lectures, he stayed with my family. And he apparently had come, I was only a baby, but he thought I was older. He sort of got in his head that I was three, and he came with all these stories he'd made up for a child. And my father said, and because you were too young, he told them to me. He said, so there I am with the greatest mind of the generation, and he's telling me children's stories.
Wow.
So I did know who he was.
So your mom, was she an academic?
No, my mother got a PhD at the Sorbonne when she was 19. Because of her bipolar, she started things and she never finished them. She had a million projects she started that never finished. And then as the disease sort of took hold more and more, she had these moments of incredible grandiosity where she would blow everything up. But she also had a great capacity for fun when she was in the middle place or in a place where she was neither, you know, lying in bed for months reading the same book over and over, or, you know, out there having shopping sprees.
Did you always know that it was a thing that was happening to her? Did you know that that wasn't the fundament of who your mother was, that there was this thing that was happening to her?
As I got older, I did. I don't think I knew it when I was very small.
Must have been so confusing as a little child.
You know, as I got older, I mean, my mother was one of the first people to be taking lithium. I mean, she took it 10 years before it was approved. And I mean, I will never forget. She had basically a nervous breakdown. And I called her psychiatrist and said, look, she's been seeing you for 5 years and she's worse than she's ever been. I was 12. And he said, this new field called psychopharmacology, and I'm going to send your mother to see one of them. And I'll never forget my mother coming home and saying, you can't imagine what a relief it is to be told that it's not my fault. You know, she said, I've been in analysis for all these years where people have said, you know, you're doing this because you hate your mother. You're doing this for this reason or that. And she said, even if they can't cure me, just the relief of being told that it's happening to me, that it isn't me, is enormous.
I'm sure. I'm sure that must have been a huge relief. But that's a lot at 12. I remember reading, you said that she just was like a horrible cook, which I'm sure was to do with like the way that she was actually wired. But the fact that she was a horrible cook, which made you into this extraordinary cook. I was thinking, did your love of food come from a lack of its sort of preparation and provision, or did it happen later?
I've always loved food. And I think part of it was that one of the ways I connected to my father was that he and I would walk New York on weekends and we would go to these food neighborhoods, you know, and he took me to Yorktown. He was German and we'd go to Yorktown. And it was like he found home in the food.
Yeah.
And then we went to Spanish Harlem and we went to the Lower East Side. And I always sort of understood food as, I mean, I loved it and I loved to eat and I loved to cook, you know, and I grew up in Greenwich Village. So the kids who went to PS 41 with me, it was like a real mix of, you know, there were Japanese kids and Italian kids. And so I loved going to their homes and eating what their mothers made. But I always thought of food as much more than just something to eat. I always thought of it as really emotional, and it was that it was about history and culture. And I discovered M.F.K. Fisher's writing when I was really young, and she sort of saw food in a way that was, you know, bigger than just recipes. So I've always been comfortable in the kitchen. I've just always liked, you know, when I don't know what else to do, I go into the kitchen.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
Same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My next question is, what question would you most like answered?
I think the thing that I'm most curious about, is there a purpose to life, or is it all just random? And I guess in some ways I'm sort of, is there a God? But it's bigger than that. It's like, do we just have to be good for our own sense of doing the right thing? Or is there some bigger reason? I mean, don't you wonder about that?
Oh, God, yes, all the time. And I've written about it quite a lot recently as well. Since my mother died, I've been obsessed is not the right word, but really preoccupied with this notion of, is meaning in life assigned, and is it assigned by us? Because I have a feeling that in this emotionless, like the universe is so beautiful and so energetically driven, but it feels like there isn't intervention. There isn't an intervention when something that we perceive as terrible is about to happen. I don't think there is anything interfering with our human experience. But it does feel like we decide what the meaning is.
But most people want to believe that that's not the case, right?
I think it's because it's frightening. I think because death is utterly terrifying. I think it is at the back of our minds all the time, this notion of there is a finite amount of time that we are here. There is a clock ticking. And the idea of there being a parental force and figure, which I'm not saying I don't believe in on some level, that there is a source energy that is bigger than us that we can choose to be a part of. I just think that this human thing, this physical reality, is purely experiential, and that us being good or being evil is up to us. I don't know that there's like a greater meaning, because it feels so much like it's just consciousness is kind of experiencing itself. It's like a flow.
that you can either be in or be out of. And the physical body bit is going to end, but perhaps tending your soul, tending your spirit, perhaps that's as much meaning as I can find. But it could be, that could also just still be an expression of my grief. I don't know.
It's really hard. And I feel like it gets harder all the time because we're making such a mess of the world as human beings.
I know. I mean, it must be strange as well, because you've also really been like revolutionary in an area. Like, you know, you say that you were part of this generation who was raised to kind of believe that they were going to get married and be taken care of by a man. And you just expressly went out and did something radical and different, not just in your own life, but then sort of affecting a whole movement around this particular thing. So it's amazing because you see what it's like to actually affect change.
But not enough change. So, man, I sort of have this feeling that we have lived through this moment, and I see the world food first, so I can describe it in food terms, but it doesn't matter how you describe it. I mean, there was kind of a moment after World War II when we as human beings had the opportunity to make life on Earth pretty wonderful. We'd conquered so many of the things that had made life miserable for most human beings for most of human history. We'd become comfortable for the first time. I mean, we weren't constantly being eaten up by insects, and we weren't, you know, always cold or always hot. The middle class was ascendant for the first time. Ordinary people were living decent lives, and it looked like everybody's children were going to have better lives than they did. And, you know, we had antibiotics, so we were conquering disease. And, you know, in food, we actually had the ability to feed most people. We could conquer hunger. And there was this moment when it really looked like the human possibility was extraordinary. And then we let it all go to hell. And what did we do? We've destroyed the climate. We've waged more war. We've made income inequality bigger than it's ever been before. You know, we've got this world where half the people are starving and the other half are obese. You know, this moment of promise, we just let it slip through our fingers. And, you know, in terms of food, we let our food become increasingly industrialized. We've let, you know, in this country, 6 out of 10 people have food-related chronic diseases. So, you know, I feel like living in Berkeley in the 70s, when we sort of saw what was happening to the food supply, and we saw, you know, that climate change was on the horizon, and we didn't fix it when we had the opportunity. So I find that incredibly frustrating, that we should have created more change. We should have stopped the future that we now have in our hands. And we didn't. And, you know, there are a million reasons for it, mostly political. But, you know, we let, you know, all our resources get exploited in a terrible way. And I'm ashamed of it. I mean, I'm ashamed of my generation that we didn't do better. Sorry, that's really depressing, but...
It's not, you know, it's interesting. Like, that's the fatal flaw of, I would say, of being human, but I mean, I've got to say, it's really men. I mean, it is. Like, if we had shared power equally through all this time, I would take responsibility or have women take responsibility partially, but it's not. It's been men driven by a greed and a resistance to evolve. But, you know, Darwin was right. It's like, evolve or die. Like, that's how it goes. I think you did a lot. I think you did an enormous amount. I don't think that any of that is lost. And if anything, it like creates a blueprint that if it's not too late, we have plenty of examples of how people can affect change in this world. Look how quickly you came up with a vaccine for COVID.
Wasn't it amazing?
Just look at that. And I know, you know, I know that we had been working on coronavirus vaccines like that predated the COVID strain. But still, when all these people came together, look what we did in a year.
And that's what's so frustrating. I mean, we have that ability. We have these giant brains that we have been using in the wrong way. And it is really frustrating that we have this capability. And look at the world we've allowed to happen.
We're trying to fix it. We're trying to fix it. So what's the quality you like least about yourself?
I'm fearful and I'm squeamish. I'm horribly, embarrassingly squeamish. I
mean, about what kinds of things?
Like blood, you know. I mean, I used to be afraid that I couldn't be a mother because what if my kid cut himself and I fainted?
Did you have a big giant sheet up when you were giving birth so that you couldn't see any of what was happening
No.
down by your apron pocket?
No, I mean, yeah, the amazing thing about giving birth is what I didn't know. I'd always been afraid of it. And then you get all these hormones that make it's all easy.
I know, good old oxytocin.
Really?
So you're squeamish and you're fearful. How is that when you're cooking? Like, how do you handle sort of butchery?
Well, butchery is fine. But, you know, if I cut myself and it bleeds really badly, it's not pretty.
So it's connected to your own mortality or the mortality of your...
No, I can faint taking the cats to the vet.
Wow.
I've always been that way. And it's very embarrassing. I hate it. I just hate it.
It probably makes you very empathetic to people who, if you see someone who is feeling fearful in that way, it probably makes you very understanding of that.
It does. and of course, the other thing, I have conquered this. I wrote about it a lot, was I'm phobic. And I was very phobic about driving over bridges and driving on, you know, the 8-lane highways of California make me crazy.
Do you get into the root of like what you think that comes from, of the phobic nature?
I think it's a way of tripping yourself up. I mean, I've never been quite sure. I mean, the only way I conquered it was by just facing it and just refusing to let it stop me. And I've written about it a lot, and I'm stunned at how many people are phobic. You know, maybe it's a way of not facing other fears, you know, real fears.
Or maybe it's a way of metabolizing them. And actually, you know, it's a very literal thing to look at a freeway with 6 or 8 lanes. And that can then become the physical embodiment of deeper fears that, you're right, can't be named.
And there is certainly something really scary about it.
Oh, terrifying. I mean, God, try driving in London where the roads were built for one small horse and carriage. And now you've got 2 Range Rover drivers with battling entitlement. It's a nightmare. What did you write about the phobic thing in? I want to read that.
I wrote about it in my first book, Tender at the Bone. And what surprised me was just how many people that you would never expect to be phobic will come up to me and say, oh, that thing about the bridges, I so understand it.
Wow.
And tunnels, terrifying. I mean, and the thing about tunnels is you can't get out. You know, once you've committed to that tunnel, you're in it.
Yes.
And then you think, like, what if I did something really terrible? What if I turned the wheel? You know.
I do. I mean, I'm glad that you resist turning the wheel and that you write about it. I do think it's so interesting how our fears play out. You know, the ones that we don't name. And we're not trained to examine and to give a name to these things that really frighten us. Like, people love to go and see horror films, and I'm convinced it's just because it's like, it's a way for them to actually scream at the fear and the terror of what it is to be alive sometimes.
Well, I will tell you, you couldn't pay me to see a horror film. I think the last horror film I saw was Psycho when I was 8, and I still won't get in a shower if I'm home alone.
No, it's hideous. I hate them. I absolutely hate them. Life is frightening enough. Like, there are enough tunnels and bridges that we actually have to go through and go over. What would be your last meal?
Well, you know, being a food person, it's a question I get asked a lot. You know, every time I answer it, I answer it differently.
I think that's okay, because the ending is maybe always changing.
But today, it being this sort of weird in-between season, that would make me happiest right this minute. If I were going to die an hour from now, what I would want right now is one perfectly ripe peach.
Ah, stone fruit.
I mean, it is hard to get a perfect peach, you know, but I mean, really juicy, the kind of peach that you have to go into the bathtub with all your clothes off to eat, you know, that just drips down. You know, the idea that they're so rare and, you know, they're fragrant, they're beautiful, and it's such an elusive flavor. I mean, you know, I've had maybe in my whole life 10 perfectly ripe peaches, but I would really love one right now.
I like that that's the holy grail of food, is like the perfect peach. I would put money on it being in Italy.
Or Georgia. Actually, you can get a really good peach in a good year in California. Frog Hollow Farm grows really good peaches up in Northern California. But the thing is that, you know, really perfect peaches don't travel. So no commercial people grow them because, you know, they're perfect when they're picked. And then the next day they're not perfect anymore. So They're not a commercial product.
I like that, though. It's like you have to go and find it. It requires your desire and lack of it being kind of immediately accessible. I think that's probably also part of the... So maybe you'd have to go on a walk to find your peach in this hour. You'd spend 45 minutes walking to find the peach, pick it, eat it, and then pop off.
And die happy.
And die happy underneath the tree.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can you tell me about something that has grown out of a personal disaster?
I'd always been afraid that I wouldn't be a good mother. I'm not a person who particularly loves babies. I like children, but babies I find kind of boring. I was really scared that it would be hard. And then we adopted a baby.
Oh, you did. Yes, that's right.
And then the birth mother changed her mind.
I just can't imagine that pain.
It was, I didn't recognize the person that I had become because I loved that little girl so much that even as I was walking her at night when she couldn't fall asleep and I was like, somebody take this child from me. And I was like, I will kill anyone who tries to take this child from me. And I wanted to leave the country with her and give up my life and leave the country. Then I miraculously became pregnant, and I am convinced that the two are connected.
Had you had trouble conceiving in your life?
Yes, and we had done everything. I had never been pregnant.
Wow.
We had gone through every kind of, you know, in vitro fertilization, years of trying to get pregnant, never been pregnant. And so we adopt Gavi, and I genuinely think that something happened with that, you know, the experience of having her and loving her so much, and then, you know, having her taken away, which was just devastating. And, you know, I would wake up thinking that she was crying for me and wondering why I never came. And then literally a month later, out of nowhere, I'm suddenly pregnant, and I was 41 years old. And our whole story had been so public in Los Angeles. I mean, actually, LA Law somebody heard it and they wrote a whole episode of LA Law kind of based on this.
Oh, wow.
And it was so public that I didn't even want to go to the drugstore and get a pregnancy test. I mean, I actually said, I was with some friends the night before and everybody was drinking. And I said, I'm not going to drink tonight. And my friend Robin said, why? And I said, I think I'm pregnant. And she said, how late are you? I said, one day. And she said, I thought you had lost it completely. I thought, okay, just losing Gavi put her over the top, poor thing. And the next day I went to the supermarket and I bought a pregnancy test. And I went into the bathroom on my way to work. And so I'm at the LA Times and I'm in there. And now it's pretty quick, but then you had to juggle all these things. So I'm in one of those stalls juggling all this. And sure enough, it comes up that I'm pregnant. And I call my gynecologist and say, you know, I just did a pregnancy test and I'm pregnant. She said, oh, those things aren't at all accurate. Don't believe it. You're not pregnant. There's no way. Come down here and I'll give you a real test. And I go down there. She says, oh my God, you are pregnant, but you can't tell anyone because the chances that you're going to actually carry this baby to term, she said, you're one day pregnant. I mean, it's like, you can't tell anyone until you're at least 3 months pregnant. And I immediately go to my husband's office. He was then the news director of the CBS station. And I'd never stopped to see him before. I stopped in on my way home from the doctor. And I said, you know, Michael, you can't tell anyone. And Michael immediately turns around and shouts to the newsroom, she's pregnant.
Oh, my goodness. What a joy. What a joy that must have been.
And then I had the easiest pregnancy. I mean, I was never sick for a moment. I worked until the day Nick was born. I never had more energy. I thought, God, if I'd known being pregnant was like this, I would have been pregnant 100 times. No wonder Ethel Kennedy had all those kids.
Wow. How amazing. I know, and please feel free to say, no, I don't want to talk about that, but did you ever have any contact with Gavi afterwards?
No, and we were sure we would. I mean, we're absolutely sure that. I mean, we fought this in court. I mean, it was a crazy story. But I feel like, I mean, I'm not a spiritual person, but I feel like we felt we had a purpose in her life. Had we given her back immediately, I mean, she was going to be the child of an unwed mother who was not very motherly. And because we went to court, the mother called her longtime boyfriend, who she had not told she was pregnant because she had dreams of a better life. And so she'd come to this country to get an abortion. But by the time she got enough money, she didn't have enough money to have an abortion. Anyway, they got married and he was like a lovely man. And so I feel like our purpose in her life was we gave her a family. I think about her all the time, and I'm glad she got to grow up with her biological parents. I hope they stayed together, and I hope she's had a good life. But I feel like she was very loved for the first 4 months of her life, and I think that matters too.
Oh, my God. Yes, it does, in your basic architecture. It does. And, you know, it's sort of right back to the beginning, that notion of purpose, you know, and self-sacrifice, and sometimes it's
sometimes it looks like you're getting a raw deal, but I don't know, invariably there's something in there. It doesn't mean it's not incredibly sad, but you got your Nick. What a miracle.
I mean, yes, it was a miracle. It worked out in the end. And I hope it did for her too.
I hope so too. Oh, Ruth, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been such an immense pleasure.
Likewise.
I'm so inspired by your life and all the things that you've done, and it makes me just want to do more, so.
This was so easy. I mean, you know, I've never met you before, and I feel like I'm talking to an old friend, so thank you.
Ruth has two more recent cookbooks entitled Garlic and Sapphires and Tender at the Bone. And from that particular book, I can only tell you, make the lemon souffle. Just finish listening to this and then go and make the lemon souffle.
Mini Questions is hosted and written by me, Minnie Driver. Supervising producer, Aaron Kaufman. Producer, Morgan Lavoie. Research assistant, Marissa Brown. Original music, Sorry Baby, by Minnie Driver. Additional music by Aaron Kaufman. Executive produced by me, Minnie Driver. Special thanks to Jim Nicolay, Will Pearson, Addison O'Day, Lisa Castella and Anique Oppenheim at WKPR, De La Pescador, Kate Driver and Jason Weinberg, and for constantly solicited tech support, Henry Driver.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.